The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
What are we? Are we just a soul inside of a prison that is waiting to escape this jail in which we live, and then we go wafting off somewhere else? You know, in our modern technological society, it's amazing to me that with all of the scientific advancements that we have, this medium, for example, of communication, where I can reach beyond a studio in the Los Angeles area in Pasadena, California, where metal particles on a tape can be scrambled as we talk into a tiny peanut-sized microphone, and where it's put onto a tape and it's shipped via an airliner to a local station somewhere, put on a tape machine, and then it's transmitted right through the radio or the airwaves, I should say, to your own set and then re-scrambled. And that's a kind of a modern miracle in one sense, where you can reach beyond your immediate environment to talk to someone. But what about this thing about death and what happens after this life that we now know? We have the unbelievable miracles of modern science and technology, of flight, of communications, of miniaturization, of man going to the moon, of incredible advancements in medical science, heart transplants and people with heart pacers and mechanical valves in their bodies. And yet at this same time, in spite of all these incredible advancements in some areas in our technological society, we still don't know what we are. We still don't know what happens when we die. We disagree on these things. Some people talk about soul sleeping. Others seem to think that when you die all over, just like the dog Rover. Others say that you become something else, and others say that you go back and you're born again, you become another human being. You know, in Tibet, you're probably familiar with the story of the Dalai Lama and how when the Lama dies, they look all over the country for a little baby that was born precisely at the instant, or as close as they can determine, to the instant of the death of the former Lama, and then this becomes the new Lama. So whatever, you know, they think that apparently the spirit just keeps going. Now, does it happen that way really because they believe it? And it doesn't happen that way somewhere else because they don't believe it? Do our minds, our attitudes, our hang-ups, our Linus blankets, our thumbs in our mouth, our fetishes, our personal tastes and desires, what we would like to believe, what we accept, what we want, does that alter what happens beyond the grave? No, of course not. Doesn't change anything. What I think, what you think, doesn't alter one whit what really happened to those little black babies, or what happened when your loved ones or friends or relatives or anybody died. There's only one possible source to which you can go to discover what happens after death, and it isn't medical science, because medical science doesn't know. Matter of fact, medical science doesn't even know what is death. The Supreme Court isn't even sure. They're still arguing about whether or not you're alive when your brain dies, but your body is still alive, or whether your heart is gone. And, well, you know, I mean, this thing of heart transplants made them take a fresh look at that, because presumably if they can't find any electrical activity in the brain, but the heart is still a living organ, they can slice open the poor guy, take the heart out. But, you know, you've seen a lot of people sitting around the classrooms, you'd suspect they're likely heart transplant candidates. You might say their brains have gone to sleep. I remember citing one man in the series I did on the high cost of dying and the subject of death, and what about the Bible doctrine of the resurrection? What about the church beliefs about the transmigration of souls, or about people becoming mosquitoes or animals, or about going to heaven or to hell, or about going to limbo or somewhere? And I was telling about the man who lay there, I don't know how many hours it was, maybe 8 or 10 or 14, and his heart was being transplanted. For a while his heart was completely out of his body, and the blood was being circulated through mechanical machinery. And he said he totally blacked out. He said he wasn't off there sitting somewhere with his chin in his hand looking down at the body and saying, "Oh, no, body, I'm not going back in there. I'm just not going to live with you anymore. I hear the pearly gates opening, and I hear the angels calling, swing low, and I'm going up there." And so the doctors would say, "Well, I don't understand it. It was a perfect transplant. Everything went very well. And that stupid soul isn't cooperating. We let it out, and it's gone. It's not coming back." No, the man survived. How long he did, I don't know. A lot of times they say the operation was a terrific success, but the patient died. So I don't know how long the man survived the transplant, but at any rate, he lost his religion. Now, he didn't lose the Bible, because the Bible said exactly what he said through pragmatic, practical experience.
He said that when he was, quote, dead, end quote, in terms of medical science, he called himself dead. Maybe they wouldn't have agreed with him since his blood was still being circulated by machinery. But he said, I was dead. And he said, while I was dead, I was completely unconscious. I didn't know anything. It was the inkiest, blackest void that you can imagine. I was nowhere. So he said, therefore, he lost his religion. Now, a lot of religions of the world believe all sorts of bizarre and rather weird things about this thing of death. It's strange, isn't it, that in the Bible, the resurrection from the dead, a bodily resurrection, a recreation of a human being, if you will, is taught throughout the Bible, in the Old Testament as well as the New. It's strange, isn't it, that while great major church organizations say the resurrection has no real part in our doctrine and we don't emphasize it, that Jesus not only emphasized it, but pointed out that the belief in the resurrection and his own individual personal resurrection was the strongest perennial proof he was to leave behind as to his messiahship. The resurrection were his credentials, his accreditation, the absolute stamp of approval that he was the Messiah. Here again we find in Matthew 12 and verse 40 the following statement in the Old King James English translation. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the whale's belly, now it's in this translation, it should say just great fish, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Now, I can't answer for churches that try to say Friday sunset, the nighttime part, and the daylight part, of course, is Saturday. So you got half of Friday remaining. Well, you got all day Friday, actually, the way they counted time then. But the way we count time today, you only have half. Because, you know, there's only half remaining until midnight. And then Saturday begins. But really, that's a different story. If you count it the way God does, you'd even come up with a little more time, two full days and two full nights. If you count it the way man does, you only got about 2 nights and 1 day, and that's it. But Jesus said 3 days and 3 nights. It's not my fault that all the major religions have rejected that time. That's their business. They have the doctrine of a Friday sunset entombment or interment of Christ after he was crucified, and then a Sunday morning resurrection, which gives you Friday night, all day Saturday, and Sunday night, and boom, and that's it. But Jesus said, and it's Matthew 12, verse 40, so you can look it up when you want to in your own Bible, as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in a whale's belly, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Now, how do Christian ministers get around that? I remember. It's an interesting story. They say, oh, well, that's a Greek idiom. Not idiot, idiom. A Greek idiom. And the Greek idiom doesn't really mean 3 days and 3 nights. It means three kind of periods, whether it's dark or light or what. So you can take these two nighttime periods and one daytime period, and that takes care of it. Oh, a Greek idiom. Well, that's strange because when you go back in the book of Jonah, it wasn't written in Greek. Jesus spoke in both Aramaic and Greek, and he said, as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so shall the Son of Man be, same length of time he is. And you go back in the book of Jonah, and that's not a Greek idiom because it's Hebrew. And it's not even a Hebrew idiom. It's just a plain statement that says 3 days and 3 nights. And of course, Christ said that would be exactly the length of time that he was in the tomb. So Christ's sign, the only perennial sign that he left behind that he was the Messiah, was a precise length of time in his tomb. Can you prove he was really in there for that period of time?
More than 7 million were sold last year. 40 different publishing companies print this book, and the total number of hundreds of millions of copies printed and distributed is impossible to estimate. It has now been translated into 1,400 different languages. The Bible, consistently every year's bestseller by a very wide margin. Obviously, a lot of people feel this book is valuable enough to become a part of their personal library. But in order to extract the real merit of this book, it must be read and studied. But how? What are the best methods? To answer these questions, we have published two booklets explaining how to go about it. Request Read the Book and How to Study the Bible, companion booklets sent free of charge. These will help you appreciate and understand the world's best seller. Read the Book
and How to Study the Bible. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
The folk rock opera Jesus Christ Superstar leaves the central hero in the crucifixion scene. And long trailing garment there, and he's up kind of a picture that he might have been alleged to have gone to heaven, but you're sort of left to make up your own conclusion. And the plaintive song is repeated over and over again, Jesus Christ Superstar, are you really who you say you are? Well, maybe that's the question for us today, because on the question of what happens to babies, what happens to your loved ones when they die, can only be resolved by going to that one source that gives us knowledge, which we cannot otherwise discover for ourselves. You can't discover what happens at death by test tubes and laboratory experiments. Even the Supreme Court doesn't really know. They're even still haggling over what is the precise moment of death, and how do you really know when death is death and not life? So they're unclear on this, in spite of all of other enormous, immense advancements in other areas of technical knowledge. Let's submit the resurrection account of the Bible to the same standard test that you would use in determining any historical event as to its historical accuracy. And let's go through it. First, what are the critical rules for proving the reliability of historical events? The resurrection of Christ is said to be an historical event. Did it happen or did it not? I'm asking the question, did Christ rise? Is he alive today or did he stay dead? All right. The first rule demands that a witness to an event must be contemporaneous. He must, you know, coexist with the event. He's got to see it with his own eyes. And the further one gets away from that occurrence, reliability diminishes proportionately. Now, we know that in massive murders and so on, that today we got everything to water down. We're not even sure that people saw it. They've got to the point today when somebody commits a murder in front of 50 million people on television, he can still plead not guilty. So I better not even deal with the way modern-day people approach this idea of whether or not you can believe an eyewitness, because we don't believe anybody today, not ourselves, not each other. We all know that every man is a dirty, rotten, inveterate liar, and he's assumed to be an inveterate liar until he proves himself otherwise. There isn't any way that you're going to believe anybody, all of which makes me wonder about this business of taking oaths, standing on one foot. No. No. You can stand on both feet. That's right. You raise your hand. Yeah. I got to get straight on these modern things that we do to attest that we're telling the truth. And then people, of course, proceed to doubt every word that the person says. So eyewitnesses are not necessarily believed today. You can have 50 people to see a crime, and the counsel for the defense, you know, is likely to say, oh, he's not a reliable witness because he takes pills, or, she was distraught, or somebody fought with his mother-in-law that morning, so don't believe anything he says. So what I'm talking about is historical criticism and standard rules for proving the reliability of historical accounts, not necessarily the way people have watered down what is right and what is wrong today. The first rule demands, then, that eyewitness testimony is your best bet. Not somebody who lived 300 years later or 1,000 years later, but somebody who was there, somebody who saw it. The second rule is more than one witness who produced a written account. The more witnesses you can muster who write about the same event, the more you can superpose these various writings, find out if they disagree, and if they don't disagree, find out whether one adds an event or a part of that event that another one leaves out, and find out whether or not you are getting the full picture. The third rule is, when many contemporary witnesses of an event are put on trial for their very lives as to the veracity of the events of which they testify, and all of their accounts never vary, and some of them are absolutely killed for their beliefs, then you would tend to say, well, that was a pretty staunch testimony. At least the man himself must have believed it, because men don't normally go out and die for something they know in their heart isn't hoax. The fourth rule, when normally hostile witnesses also agree in all of their accounts, you can be fairly certain you're getting an accurate, reliable statement. When contemporary witnesses, normally hostile to one another, say essentially the same thing about the event, credibility becomes even surer. These are fairly good rules. They're not way-out rules. They're honest and they're accurate and they are objective rules. So let's take the resurrection account of Jesus Christ of Nazareth of the New Testament and subject that resurrection to these rules and see how we come out with regard to the historicity, or let's say the veracity, of the very sign of the Messiahship of Jesus Christ. The only one that he gave is a perennial sign to his Messiahship. All right, the first rule, remember, states that the account of an historical event should be contemporaneous to that event, or in other words, an eyewitness account. Let's apply this to the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew was strongly Judaic in flavor. It's heavily oriented toward the Jews of the Palestinian area, and some scholars say that it could have originally been written in the Hebrew language. It is so oriented toward the Judaic flavor of the time. Early testimony is unanimous in saying that Matthew wrote out his account and sent it to the people of Judea. It is supposed to be the very first book of the New Testament. Some say maybe 1 Thessalonians, the letter of the Apostle Paul to the church of Thessalonica, was the first one historically to be written. It was written less than 35 years after the death of Jesus Christ. Now, if Matthew's account were of events that never occurred, let's think of this now, if it's a fabrication out of whole cloth, a story that Matthew made up, to which later writers all testified, a lot of people give me these songs and dances when they want to get around what the Bible says. They say, now, we know that those men weren't perfect, and we know they couldn't remember everything they saw perfectly, and we know that a lot of them wanted to believe these good things about Jesus, and we know they didn't write until years later, and others came along and wrote about what they'd written, and we know that history tends to pervert things, and so we know it can't be true. Well, take all of these arguments, all these things we think we know, and subject them to this critical analysis as we're doing step by step in this short series of programs on the subject of the resurrection. Let's remember one thing. If Matthew's account were of things that never happened, he would have been subject to very severe criticism from his own contemporaries. The question is, was he?
A nation is only as strong as its families. If our nation were as strong as your family, how strong would it be? And if relationships in your family are not what you would like, where can you go for help? Plain Truth, a publication of understanding, is concerned. Every Plain Truth brings you helpful articles on how relationships can be strengthened between husband and wife, parents and children, families and neighbors, with interesting and useful information on helping your child enjoy learning at home and school, budgeting and sensible use of credit, preventing teenage depression, household health and safety, homemaking tips for the working mother, achieving full human potential, coping with inflation. Plain Truth emphasizes quality in all aspects of daily living. Let Plain Truth help strengthen your family and nation. Request your free subscription today. Dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
The Gospel according to Matthew, one of the Gospel writers, has never been challenged by any contemporaneous people who lived alongside Matthew at that day. Never forget one thing, that Matthew wrote not only the resurrection, not only the crucifixion, not only the events leading up to it, but of dozens of miracles, including healing of people by name, including all kinds of miracles involving a fig tree, the feeding of the 4,000 and 5,000, walking on water, healing of sick people, casting out of demons, healing of lepers, and all sorts of things of this nature. Take the example of the feeding of thousands of people on the other side of the Lake of Galilee. Now, Matthew came from that area. Matthew was a tax collector. Matthew was known by many people in that glittering gem of a city beside the Sea of Galilee called Capernaum, which was a crossroads where the east met the west. It really was. I have a great deal more I'd like to give you on that sometime, because people tend to think of the time during which Jesus lived as a rocky desert area where people lived in little old rock huts and they walked around barely clothed and herding sheep and driving camels around, and it was just one step this side of the Stone Age. Nothing could be further from the truth. The city of Capernaum was a glittering example of modern architecture and engineering, many times with indoor plumbing, with a fabulous glittering streets of mosaics that looked like anything in Rio or anywhere you could go in the world today, and probably finer than what you would find in most cities of the world today. Matthew was well known. He writes that on one occasion, thousands of his own countrymen in that narrow little area of those many towns around Galilee were fed by a miracle by Jesus Christ. He's writing of this less than 35 years later. To all of these events, all of these miracles, all of the parables, all of the teachings, the narrow escapes in Jerusalem, the final death scene in Jerusalem, and the resurrection, and the 40 days during which Jesus appeared to them over and over and again where the doors were closed, he appeared to them in Galilee, in northern Israel, in southern Israel, and all over the place, Matthew says he was an eyewitness. And you know, every one of the other gospel writers say the same thing, and they never disagree. One adds an event that another one might have left out, so that one gospel account might be a little more complete in one area than the other. But none of them disagree. And furthermore, there is not one shred, not one scrap of evidence that has ever been dug up, archaeologically or historically, which contradicted Matthew's eyewitness account. Yet at the time Matthew wrote of those events, there were thousands of people still alive who were included as a part of the people in the scenario, who were there when it happened, who were supposed to be among those who were fed. People who had been healed of Jesus were still walking around, not dead yet. People who had been fed by him, people who had sat at his feet and been taught by him, people who had seen their brothers or their sisters or mothers healed by him, were still alive when Matthew wrote the account. Let's take a modern parallel to fully understand the situation with Matthew. Suppose some modern writer in the year 1973 wrote that a well-known prophet less than 35 years ago had gone throughout all the United States working many miracles so that thousands followed him from place to place. And that on Times Square in New York on December 31st, 1938, when huge crowds were present, that same prophet had been executed. And people were claiming that this was true, it really happened. Now, if such a thing had happened back in 1938, there would still be alive many tens of thousands of people. There would be alive millions who would have presumably heard of it in the press. And there would be alive thousands who would have been eyewitnesses who are still alive to either corroborate or to testify that it's a lie, one way or the other. If such a thing had never happened, no writer today could get away with such an incredibly fallacious story. It couldn't happen. I think that's logical. I think it's fair. And I think you ought to apply it to the story that is given, not a story, but the truth, the eyewitness account of Matthew. Now, despite the multitudes of witnesses, not one contemporaneous objection exists in all of history or all of archaeology that has ever been found to try to refute Matthew's gospel. All right, the second rule. Many eyewitnesses. The second rule demands that many eyewitnesses must have seen the event in order to give it credence. I don't know why, but you know, you don't want to believe one person. You believe 10, a dozen, 10,000, 60,000. The execution of Jesus was witnessed by many, and people of all interest, people who wanted him dead so bad they could taste it, disinterested Romans who honestly just didn't care but must have enjoyed the spectacle, family and friends, disciples who fled, his own mother who stood afar off, people who were at once shaken to the core of their being by it and desired with all their hearts to see him avoid it, who were brokenhearted, people who were fearful, who had fled and had said no with curses, as Peter did. I don't have anything to do with him. He's not even a friend of mine. I don't know him. But it was done before thousands of people. And at Passover time, there were an estimated 2 million people in Jerusalem. No, not 64 with one crippled old man. The way people try to envision it in the old, you know, the pictures we have in the old worn-out family Bibles and so on. There were 2 million people, historians tell us, in Jerusalem at the time of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. It took place at the time of the Passover. Josephus says at least 2 million people used to gather every year at Jerusalem at the Passover time. This would have meant several thousand people saw Jesus enduring his trial. Thousands, maybe tens of thousands, lined the road as he dragged his stake to the place of his crucifixion. Thousands later saw that body along with the others up there on that hill. Thousands knew of it, and not only there, but they knew about it all through the Eastern Mediterranean and clear to Rome and beyond. Christ was tried by the Supreme Court of the day, the Supreme Court of Judaism, the Sanhedrin. That would be precisely like the House of Lords of Great Britain judging a person today. He was also brought before Caiaphas, who was the high priest of that nation. That would be like being brought before the Archbishop of Canterbury, or the Pope himself. It would be like being brought before the highest religious figure, maybe a person who was also very highly regarded in the state of any great nation of today. He was judged by Pilate, the Roman governor, a person whose rule has been proved, by the way, by archaeology. Pilate is no figment of somebody's imagination, but a person whom archaeology identifies from, as we say, profane or secular sources. And Pilate would have been precisely like a present prime minister of Britain. He was examined by Herod Antipas, which would have been just exactly like being examined by the king himself. And this was the son of Herod the Great, who had been the king of the Jews. This would have been similar to a king of England witnessing the trial. So you have all these people involved. Not only then were common people eyewitnesses, but so were all of the top people representing the local government, the local occupational authority, and the very seat of Rome itself. These were eyewitnesses to those events. I ask then, can you believe these events one way or the other? Do you know whether or not you can believe them? You need to write for the booklets that we've been telling you about in this program, and especially the booklet on what happens after death. That's the booklet that I want you to get. What happens after death? When you die, then what? This booklet, After Death, What Then, is based precisely upon what the Bible says. Jesus said in verse 21 of the 5th chapter of the book of John, "For as the Father raises up the dead and quickens them," that means enlivens them, makes them alive, "even so the Son quickens," or makes alive, "whom he will. For as the Father judges no man," he has committed all judgment unto the Son, "that all men should honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. He that honors not the Son honors not the Father which has sent him." Then he went on to talk about those who had passed from death unto life, and he said, "The hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God." Well, when does that happen? Does it happen the moment they die, or 10 minutes later, or a year later? Or does it happen at a precise moment in the future that yet has not occurred? This booklet, After Death, What Then?, answers every single one of these questions. How many resurrections are there? One or two or more? And do you have a soul that goes somewhere when you die? What about purgatory? You write for this free booklet, After Death, What Then? Or just mention the one on death. It is free of charge. There is no price. It's absolutely biblical. You can check up and find out. You can underline, make notations in the margin of your own Bible. And when you finish reading this booklet, you will know. You will have the Bible answers to that question. You'll probably know more about it than your minister does if you're not awful careful. I mean, you should probably stop short of that, but I'd want you to read the entirety of the booklet, read the whole thing, and find out what the Bible says about it. So write for that booklet, After Death, What Then? Next time, we'll continue along with some of these vital questions and subject this entire account to a real fine-tooth comb, the historicity of the resurrection. Did it really happen? Is it true? And can you prove it? We want to look into it technically. We don't want to look into it emotionally, but now we're taking a different tack. Not some emotional point of view, but whether or not the contemporary records agree with one another, whether or not it is an historical account or just a theological account. All you need to do to receive the booklet we've mentioned is to send your request to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, and we'll send it to you by return mail free of charge. Or if you don't live inside the state of California, you can call the toll-free number, which will follow. Now, articles just like this Plain Talk, will be coming along in the Plain Truth magazine just about every single issue. You can have that kind of copy if you write for the Plain Truth. It's free of charge. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong. Goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.